This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
While much of the Allied world is already celebrating VE Day, the official announcement that the war in Europe has ended will not be made until tomorrow. Earlier, CBS correspondent Edward Murrow in London said that President Truman and Prime Minister Churchill were ready to announce the official news of the German surrender at 9 a.m. today, but he said that they were delayed because Premier Stalin, scheduled to speak at the same time, was not ready. The first Associated Press flash from Reims in France, saying that Germany had surrendered, was followed 2 hours later by a broadcast by ABSI, the American broadcasting station in Europe. Supreme Headquarters, in the meantime, had issued a statement not denying the truth of the AP flash, but saying that no official announcement had been authorized.
This is the BBC Home Service. We're interrupting programs to make the following announcement. It is understood that in accordance with arrangements between the three great powers, an official announcement will be broadcast by the Prime Minister at 3 o'clock tomorrow, Tuesday afternoon, the 8th of May. In view of this fact, tomorrow, Tuesday, will be treated as Victory in Europe Day and will be regarded as a holiday. The day following, Wednesday, the 9th of May, will also be a holiday. His Majesty the King will broadcast to the peoples of the British Empire and Commonwealth tomorrow, Tuesday, at 9 p.m. British Double Summertime.
Bletchley Station! Bletchley Station!
I was a bomb operator at Eastcote on Sea Watch. Sea Watch was actually on duty when they announced VE Day.
Yesterday morning at 2:41 a.m. at General Eisenhower's headquarters, General Jodl, the representative of the German High Command and of Grand Admiral Dönitz, the designated head of the German state, signed the act of unconditional surrender of all German land, sea, and air forces in Europe to the Allied Expeditionary Force and simultaneously to the Soviet High Command. General Beadle Smith, Chief of Staff of the United States Army, and General François Sévez signed the document on behalf of the Supreme Commander of the Allied Expeditionary Force. And General Suslow Parov signed on behalf of the Russian High Command. Today, this agreement will be ratified and confirmed at Berlin, where Air Chief Marshal Tedder, Deputy Supreme Commander of the Allied Expeditionary Force, and General de Lattre de Tassigny will sign on behalf of General Eisenhower. General Zhukov will sign on behalf of the Soviet High Command. The German representatives will be Field Marshal Keitel, Chief of the High Command, and the Commanders-in-Chief of the German Army, Navy, and Air Forces. Hostilities will end officially at 1 minute after midnight tonight, Tuesday the 8th of May. But in the interest of saving lives, the ceasefire began yesterday to be sounded all along the fronts, and our dear Channel Islands are also to be freed today.
So it stopped the following day. The chief officer gave us all a little pep talk. Well, I think she thought we were all going to lose our honour because of everybody feeling free and throwing away caution to the winds and celebrating and drinking. She was, oh, woman, it's been terrible for her. And we all rushed up to London and throwing the crowds there outside the palace, shouting and marching them down Piccadilly with about 20 Canadian Air Force officers all arm in arm. Had a marvellous day, and then we slept in the YWCA Baker Street, which we always did. Came back to Eastcote the next day, and it must have been the following day then that we then sat outside. There was a heat wave, sat outside and smashed up the bombs. Well, didn't actually smash them. The Air Force boys, who were GCHQ engineers, they had dismantled the big things, and we had all the small stuff and all these hundreds of drums. We had to take them apart. Everything was counted, screws and bearings and so on.
Did that make you feel, oh, what have we been doing?
No, that made we were all happy. That was it. It was the end of it.
The Germans are still in places resisting the Russian troops. But should they continue to do so after midnight, they will, of course, deprive themselves of the protection of the laws of war and will be attacked from all quarters by the Allied troops. It is not surprising that on such long fronts and in the existing disorder of the enemy, the commands of the German High Command should not in every case have been obeyed immediately. This does not, in our opinion, with the best military advice at our disposal, constitute any reason for withholding from the nation the facts communicated to us by General Eisenhower of the unconditional surrender already signed at Reims. Nor should it prevent us from celebrating today and tomorrow, Wednesday, as Victory in Europe Day. Today, perhaps, we shall think mostly of ourselves. Tomorrow, we shall pay a particular tribute to our heroic Russian comrades whose prowess in the field has been one of the grand contributions to the general victory.
VE Day, our little boss came out, Mr. Freddie Freeborn. He came out and was so excited, and he said, the war's ended in Europe. It's just been announced the war's ended in Europe. Well, of course, cards went all up in the air, didn't they? We all danced around, and you know, it was lovely. And then after a bit, the supervisor and he said, "Now, come on, that's enough. No, tidy up. And I think it was a Wednesday, he said, when you've tidied up and left everything and cleaned out things, he said, you can go home, but be back on Monday because we've still got the Far Eastern War to clean up. And we have to do the same thing with different codes. We tidied up, but I looked under the chair of the girl in front, because we were like school. There was a desk and a seat and a desk, I think about 60 of them in that room. And I saw one card. And I thought, oh, if I go and pick that up and go and found a card, I thought, blow that. So I knelt down and somehow or other got it under my skirt and tucked it in, because knickers had elastic in them those days. So I tucked it in my knicker neck, and then I eventually got the chance to rescue it and roll it up and put it higher up. So I've still got that one card that I pinched from Bletchley Park.
The German war is therefore at an end. after years of intense preparation, Germany hurled herself on Poland at the beginning of September 1939. And in pursuance of our guarantee to Poland, and in common with the French Republic, Great Britain, the British Empire, and Commonwealth of Nations declared war upon this foul aggression. After gallant France had been struck down, we from this island and from our united empire maintained the struggle single-handed for a whole year until we were joined by the military might of Soviet Russia and later by the overwhelming power and resources of the United States of America. Finally, almost the whole world was combined against the evildoers who are now prostrate before us. Our gratitude to all our splendid allies goes forth from all our hearts in this island and throughout the British Empire. We may allow ourselves a brief period of rejoicing. But let us not forget for a moment the toils and efforts that lie ahead. Japan, with all her treachery and greed, remains unsubdued. The injuries she has inflicted upon Great Britain, the United States, and other countries, and her detestable cruelties, call for justice and retribution. We must now devote all our strength and resources to the completion of our tasks, both at home and abroad. Advance Britannia! Long live the cause of freedom! God save the King!
So, May 1945, there was the German surrender.
Yeah.
8th of May. Do you remember that?
Very well. Yeah. We had a big party there. Everybody was very happy. And that was at Tatnow anyway. I put a great big V on top of the building. Yeah. With lights on it. Yeah.
We knew we were covering Germans and Italians in Europe. We didn't know much about how it was progressing. We didn't get much news because everything was secret. But when finally they told us that the Germans had surrendered, they said, we'll have a group photograph, because we never had a group photograph before. No. So it was to commemorate the end of the German war.
Yes.
And then we went back through the Mediterranean, up the Irish Sea to Liverpool again. Ordinary things that everyone ought to do. I'm living in a kind of daydream. I'm happy as a king.
When the war with Germany came to an end, did everything just stop?
We got very drunk.
Yes, what did you do on VE Day? Yes.
fell in the lake along with a great many other people. I don't know whether there was more than one boat, but there was a boat on the lake. And we were allowed, I don't know where we got the beer. There must have been access to drink and alcohol in BP itself. Yeah. Though I can't remember now where that was.
I mean, there was presumed to be a naffy or something.
Yes, a naffy, yeah. Yes. But it was a lengthy, prolonged celebration, of course. Yes, as I say, several of us fell in. But there you go.
the thought of you, the very thought of you, my love.
Flower Down and Scarborough, you're listening to German traffic.
Mm, mm.
And Hampstead is where you're listening to the Japanese traffic?
Yes, it must have been. And when we were up in Scarborough, I remember how awful we were, really. I mean, disgusting, I thought, the way we behaved.
Whatever did you do?
We all came out, and you see, the war was over. We'd heard the war was over, or at least the war with Germany was over. And we knew that there were some German prisoners of war in the field near us. We all went up and blew on bits of grass, Morse code, saying, "War is over. We have won." Awful. In German, I don't know.
You were saying this in German?
Yes, we did.
Why, do you speak German?
No, but somebody told us what to say, so we said, "War is over, and we have won.
That's a bit beastly. They've already been beaten.
I know. We just decided we'd jolly well tell them.
A very great crowd is collected already. Thousands upon thousands of people gathered to share this historic day with the King and Queen. The entire space, the whole roadway, the whole pavement, and the whole scene is one dense mass of people. People in the gayest colours, red, white and blue rosettes, red, white and blue hats, streamers, flags.
Tell me about VE Day. How did that feel?
Well, I mean, as I say, we're so excited because, as I say, we went right down to London.
Yes.
And everyone was dancing about, and in Piccadilly. And that was when the procession came through, the tinker right in the front. Marvellous, really. All sort of, Heather was so delighted, of course. And we were all delighted. Well, we were particularly delighted with him.
Did you go down to the palace?
We didn't see the Queen or anyone, because I believe the Queen, so they say that she came out. We didn't see her.
There are still signs of the long years we've gone through. Right opposite me still, I see a yellow trench shelter sign, and also the broken columns of the palace where the bomb hit during the Blitz. One reminder to us of how much their majesties shared the life of their people during this civilians' war.
You must have been at Bletchley on VE Day as well.
Well, I was on leave, so no, I was sorry about that. I was staying with my parents. But my father had to go up to London the following day, and we'd arranged to go to the theatre that night, my mother, father and myself, and we did. And of course London was absolutely seething with people, very excited. And my father, who was a very quiet man and had served in both world wars and had a terrible time in the 1914 war, and it was very unlike him, he said, "Come on, we're going down to Buckingham Palace." And we did, and that was great. So perhaps I did rather well out of that.
VE Day. You told me you weren't allowed to...
We weren't allowed to go into London at all. So we'd been on day watch, fortunately, and Pam and I climbed out of our bedroom window and must have gone in on the underground into London. Of course, it was absolutely packed, went into Trafalgar Square. Everything was free. All the pubs were open. Everybody was just drinking. And there was a special restaurant called Bertarelli's in Soho that Pam and I had gone to quite frequently before. And we went up to Bertarelli's and they gave us a lavish meal and wouldn't let us pay for anything. And then we went down to Trafalgar Square. But I felt rather sad, really, because two of my brothers had gone in the war, and somehow everybody rejoicing like that had this, made me cry now, had this sort of sad effect on me. However, we managed to get the milk train back to go on watch. Well, we had to go on divisions first, and we had to be in uniform, which, of course, we were anyway. We managed to get on divisions in time. Goodness knows, we must have been a bit sort of high, I should think.
And now, oh, what wonderful luck. At this moment, how wonderful, Mr. Churchill has come out onto the Ministry of Health balcony. Now, Mr. Churchill stands on the balcony of the Ministry of Health He's wearing his boiler suit, the famous boiler suit that he's made so wonderful. And he had the audacity, shall I say, to put on his head his famous black hat. Nobody can say that it goes with a boiler suit, but you heard what a cheer it raised from the crowd. He stands now in the floodlights, and he's giving the victory sign for all his might from the flooded balcony.
So you got married. John went to Stanmore. You went to Eastcote. May 1945, German surrender. VE Day. What do you remember about that?
Oh, a lot. Right. That was a big day for me, and as VE Day was the official one as well. Yeah. But the VE Day, the spontaneous one, if you like, John, of course, was at Stanmore, and I was at Eastcote. And he got in touch with me, and we went up, and we stood outside Buckingham Palace. We did all the things that people did, and watched the royals come out onto the balcony, and I remember people playing around in the fountains. You were carried along by the flow, and then John insisted I went home and stayed at Stanmore overnight, and they absolutely horrified me, but I did it. Went back to Eastcote the next morning, petty officer and all as I was, a fear of trembling that I'd be carpeted for, you know, nobody cared a hoot. The war was over, and we were just all, you know. So
you stayed in his quarters at Stanmore?
For a night.
For a night.
And I hid under the blankets when his orderly came in with his tea. I really was horrified. I went and got pyjamas from Nancy, my pal.
Right.
And it was crazy, crazy.
So VE Day, war in Europe, did the work carry on or did it change from that
point? It stopped on VE Day just like that. Because there would be a section, the Japanese section, that would continue. But my memory is that the work just stopped. I couldn't believe it when peace was declared.
Yeah. So what did you do?
That was in the May, and they took us on trips to court and to see the world. I was at Eastcote, and I don't remember being asked to do any clearing up at all. I just remember that it was almost as if they were entertaining us till they could demob us.
This is your victory. Victory of the cause of freedom is every day. In all our long history, we have never seen a greater day than this. Everyone, man or woman, has done their bit. Everyone has tried, none has flinched. Neither the long years, nor the dangers, nor the fierce attacks of the enemy have in any way weakened the unbending resolve of the British nation. God bless you all.
Oh, we used to have fun, we did. I mean, most of the chaps that were there had done years in Italy and had come back and were really then working up to demob. So it wasn't a very dark time. I suppose it was for the beginning, but if you remember in 1945, well, you don't remember, but in 1945, things were definitely looking up after the invasion, and it looked okay all the time then, so we began to
hope, didn't you?
And I remember VE night, I was in Trafalgar Square. There's a picture in there of Trafalgar Square. Well, I was in that melee on VE night.
And now listen, the band is playing Land of Hope and Glory, and the crowd is singing, and this suddenly has become a very moving moment, for Mr. Churchill too is singing, and he is conducting the singing of this song. Will you listen, please?
Oh!
Did you celebrate VE Day at all?
Well, no, because I was on night duty for VE, and there was no question of celebrating until VE plus two, when I decided I would go up to London, and the Glassborough twins were off duty that day, so I invited them to go up with me. And we met this chap in London whom I knew, and he took us to outside Buckingham Palace, and there was still quite a lot of excitement, but not obviously as great as if I'd been able to go the first evening. And then we sat in Green Park, and he produced a big bottle of gin and a bottle of baby's orange juice, which I don't know how he obtained that, because he wasn't married. He certainly had no access to babies that I knew of. But anyway, and we sat there, and we drank all this. And we all got completely whistled, particularly the Glassboroughs, who were worse than me. And somehow I had to go back onto night duty. And somehow or other, I think he must have put us on the right bus. Somehow I managed to get us off at Euston Station. But in the meantime, I lost my handbag under the seat. And I remember, I couldn't have cared less. Normally, I'd be in an absolute state of having lost my handbag. Anyway, I must have retrieved my handbag in time to get off the bus. And we went into Euston Station. And the two girls wanted to go to the loo. And they were banging on the loo door like mad. And it was locked. So I had to explain to them it was locked and they hadn't got a hope of getting in. Anyway, and then we got on the train and I managed to push them off at the stop before Bletchley, where they were billeted. And then I went on to Bletchley. So I was partially responsible for the grandmother of the Duchess of Cambridge getting pickled.
That's a claim to fame.
News of the final German surrender set off mass celebrations in scores of cities throughout the Allied world. In London, thousands of American soldiers cheered and embraced each other in a manner reminiscent of triumphant football crowds. A sign was posted at the biggest Red Cross club in London informing American Army personnel that upon official notice of VE Day, all passes and furloughs are to be extended 48 hours. Throughout the United States, America has greeted the news with shouts of jubilation and quiet prayers of thanks. New York's famous Times Square has been roped off and all vehicular traffic was stopped in the financial district. Thousands left their offices to parade on the streets with flags and banners. Meanwhile, there are reports that fighting is still in progress on the European continent. Czechoslovakian sources in London say it's possible that tank vanguards of the American Third Army have entered Prague. At the last unofficial report, the Third Army was within 12 and a half miles of the Czech capital. The Swedish Home Radio Service said that an Allied naval force of 48 ships has been sighted at the entrance to Oslo Fjord and that a landing on Norwegian soil is expected at any moment. Marshal Stalin announced in an order of the day that Russian troops have captured Breslau. Another war criminal has been captured and another Allied hero has been liberated. Allied troops have found Anton Musset, the leader of the Dutch Nazi Party, at his headquarters in Utrecht, Holland. Musset, one of Holland's most hated traitors, is believed to be in good health. At the same time, it's disclosed that the former Premier of Austria, Kurt Schuschnigg, has been liberated from a German concentration camp. In newly surrendered Denmark, Danish patriots have arrested 2,500 collaborators in their first 2 days of search. Sporadic shooting still is going on in the streets of Copenhagen. Elsewhere on the European news front, Spain severed diplomatic relations with Germany. The official announcement was made only 24 hours after Portugal's break with the beaten Nazi government.
On the day of VE Day, we were still on duty tracking V2s, even though there were virtually none at all happening then. But we had a feeling that peace might be declared, but it wasn't definite. And I came off duty at 8 in the morning, and as I came out to go across for breakfast at the mess, a little black car came to a sudden halt in front of me, and two pilots came out of it. They rushed up and hugged me and said, "You're the first English woman we have seen since 1940. And I saw on the car they'd written PWX, X Prisoners of War. And they said, "We were shot down in 1940. And a few days ago, the guards had started leaving the camp
taking their uniforms off because they realised that the British troops would very soon overtake them and probably they would then be captured. They managed to steal one of the cars and they travelled only at night because they had no idea how far liberation had happened of Belgium and Holland. They must have been somewhere north of Hanover, I think, and they quietly worked their way through. They stole petrol from the fields, from the tractors. They dug up mangel wurzels or turnips and picked things off the bushes if there were fruit of any sort, travelled only at night, and then laid doggo during the day. And it was only when they got into Belgium and crossed over the border that they realised there was liberation, so they went on driving. I took them in the mess, gave them a big breakfast, and the CO said to me, find out what they want to do. So I said to them, what do you want to do? We want to go back to Rotterdam to find the nurses that rescued us from the aircraft and give them some food, because food was so scarce. So the CO said, right, fill up a big box, take another WAF with you, you better stay with them. So the four of us then turned round and went back towards Rotterdam. And we got to the side of the river. And when we got there, the bridges had been blown up. So we couldn't go over the bridge to get to Rotterdam. And then we saw a man in a flat-bottom boat bringing supplies over. So we said to him, will you take us over? And he said, no, because the river is mined still. And I just go over there and get food in this boat. I can take the supplies, but if I took people, we would hit the mines. So we gave them the address and the food, and I often wonder whether it ever got to the nurses, because food was so valuable and he could have made a lot of money on the black market. I don't know. We drove back, and the CO said to me, you look tired, you've been awake for 36 hours. The medical officer gave me a sleeping tablet. So I went back to my billet, went to bed, and I thought, this is stupid, this is VE day. So I got up, put a new shirt on, went back to the mess, and the medical officer said, I thought this would happen. Take this. And he gave me a Benzedrine. So off I went in this little car with the two pilots and a couple of other WAF officers. We went into Brussels and celebrated VE day there. We were given cakes and flowers and bottles of wine by the Belgians, all celebrating. At the beginning, I was very sleepy, but by the time the end of the evening came, everybody else was sleepy and I was bright as a button. It's the first time in my life I've had a downer followed by an upper.
What I have to say is very simple and quite short. I would ask you all to remember those of our comrades who fell in the struggle. They gave their lives that others might have freedom, and no man can do more than that. I believe that he would say to each one of them, well done, thou good and faithful servant. And we who remain have seen the thing through to the end. We all have a feeling of great joy and thankfulness that we have been preserved to see this day. We must remember to give the praise and thankfulness where it is due. This is the Lord's doing, and it is marvellous in our eyes.
Now, when VE Day came, you were in the QR at the time of VE Day. Did it just everything just stop all of a sudden?
I'd already had a huge adventure, but everybody else, I think that's how it went to stop. This is them having their celebration. Mm. And you might say, is there anybody missing? And they would say, well, there was just one woman that worked with us all the time. And that was Helene. Mm. And I was missing because my husband, he'd arrived back 1 or 2 days before. And that was a very good of Jack Winton to do that. I'm sure Jack Winton must be dead by now. I said, how do I ever find them? I said, I know he's back, but I mean, how do I know where to go in the whole country? Even if it was only London, how would I know? I remember he looked at me and he said, well, I shouldn't do anything really to help you, but I'm going to all the same. And I said, well, how can you? And he said, I can tell you where you can phone them. I know where they're overnighting. I think I can tell you. It's in Harrogate, he said. I said, Harrogate? And he said, yes. And I said, so I'd have to ring Harrogate. And he said, yes. I said, where are these chaps ringing? He said, they're not allowed to ring. Oh, so they have to get back to London before they can. I said, how would he ever find me here? And he said, I didn't know. I think the whole thing is terrible, but I'm going to take a chance and say, if you can ring at Harrogate. Well, I couldn't ask him for any more. So I went home and wondered how I was going to get there. They had no phone in the digs. And I thought the only thing would be that pub called the Galleon. I thought, how on earth could I get to the Galleon by myself? I couldn't, because blackout. And so how could I walk something like 3-4 miles in the blackout across the fields? And a funny thing happened, as they said. I was sitting in the bus feeling really low and thinking, I'll never be able to find John. That's going to be the big snag. And onto the bus came this, oh, I wouldn't have known him, except that he was professor of English at Aberdeen for a while. And he was always, you know, coming after me, why can't you come out for a date? I mean, let's just go and forget the whole thing and all this stuff. And I thought, well, that would be the only person, because I knew he was very keen on going to the pub. Who comes onto the bus but this awful chap who knew me, not just because I was at Bletchley, but because he'd lectured at Aberdeen, you see. Normally, I'd have thought, oh, crumbs, no, I'm going to pretend I'm keeping a seat for somebody, you know. But I thought, oh, he might be one to ask how you get over there. Hello, he said. I thought, oh, no. So he said, can I sit down here? Are you keeping the seat for anyone? I said, no. So he sat down. And he said, you look terribly sad. And I said, well, I am terribly sad. I started to tell him this story. I'm terribly sad. And I said, I don't know how I'm going to do it. But in that pitch black by myself. He said, well, why would you go by yourself? And I said, well, how else am I going? He said, you've only got to ask me. And I thought, well, I thought this is being mean because I would never normally have asked him. And he came and picked me up. And then I could see that dear old couple now. They, you know.
Thought, your dicks, you're
yeah,
talking about.
They thought, how could she go with this chap? Because, but here, where, I mean, so that long story, I cut it short, but we walked across the fields to this Galleon. And when we walked in, they all started clapping. So I realised only then that, because he was a musician, you know.
He was a musician. He wrote the music for Dylan Thomas.
That's right. He wrote the oratorio, whatever it was, for Dylan Thomas's funeral.
Anyway, he played the piano, and so they were delighted to see
it. So we walked in, the two of us, and they all started clapping. They were welcoming him because they'd got an evening's entertainment. He was going to sit at the piano and play, you know, which he did.
And then he helped you with the phone call, and you got through and so on.
Yeah.
So that's a long story as to why Helene's not there in the picture on VE Day.
Yes, that's true.
This is a solemn but glorious hour. I wish that Franklin D. Roosevelt had lived to see this day. General Eisenhower informs me that the forces of Germany have surrendered to the United Nations. The flags of freedom fly all over Europe. For this victory, we join in offering our thanks to the Providence which has guided and sustained us through the dark days of adversity and into light. Much remains to be done. The victory won in the West must now be won in the East. The whole world must be cleansed of the evil from which half the world has been freed.
When the war with Germany finished, presumably your work finished.
It finished overnight, and the first thing they had to do something with us, because there we were, off of end, nothing to do. And what I remember they did with us straight away was put us into lorries every morning, a whole group of us, drive us to Denham, where there was a tomato farm, and in those days, maybe different now, I don't know, the tomatoes grew flat on the ground. And we had to pick the tomatoes, harvest the tomatoes in the sunshine. It was a pleasant job, sunny autumn, late summer weather. And on the other side of the field, there was a group of very handsome German prisoners of war. They were doing the same thing. And we weren't allowed to fraternize with them, or sorrow size, whatever
yes.
the equivalent is. We just also had to nod to them. Yeah. They had their picnic, and we had our picnic with nice fresh bread and cheese. And the other thing I remember was that there was a wall. On the other side of the wall was Denham Studios. And what was looking over the wall was a sphinx a papier-mâché sphinx, a huge one that had been made for the Caesar and Cleopatra film with Vivian Lee that was being made at that time. So it was quite a vivid memory. For several days, we picked tomatoes. By then, the war was over anyway. We could have... I mean, there was nobody saying you mustn't talk to them. But it was quite fun to do. The whole thing was quite fun, that particular episode. The farmer gave us a nice lunch, and we were out in the sunshine. It's just a very vivid, single memory. These men doing... They were probably much faster at it than we were. We were taking it in a rather ladylike, sort of half-serious way, but we were doing what we were asked to do.
We were up in Reims when the end of war happened. We had got up there into these buildings which were surrounding a square. The Americans were over there, and we moved in, and very, very soon the volume of traffic soared. So obviously something was happening, but we had not a clue. We had not a clue until one evening we were in a room which had glass partition, which then the corridor led on to other rooms at the end. And on this occasion, passing by was General Jodl with other generals, all in their long overcoats, being escorted, of course, by British soldiers. And our officer commanding was a man called Jock Watt. Now, Jock, as soon as they disappeared, he poked his head round the door and he said, "You've just seen the end of the war." And that is, in fact, what it was. Mm. So General Jodl had gone on for the signing, and we kept on bashing out these messages, and it was a tremendous volume of traffic that we got through over the next 3 to 4 days.
When the war was over, we were all at the front there. We were taken outside, you know, the big, big announcement that was going to be made. And then they said, "Oh, the war with Germany is over." Great cheers. And all the German people sort of cheered like anything. But we were on the Japanese one. Our faces drooped a bit, I think. We toddled off back to work. So it was a bit of a...
For SOs, typists, checkers, compilers, traffic controllers. Files for Captain Barber, Flight Sergeant Proctor, and Flight Sergeant Gledo. For all in Hut 3 signals. As redistribution of 3S personnel is likely to commence at very short notice, this 3S is the only sure means at my disposal to express to all of you my sincere appreciation of the help that you have given so willingly for so long. I am in no way exaggerating in saying that never have I been in an office where more cooperation and good feeling has existed, and the resultant high standard in work is something of which all can be proud. Good luck to all in the future. Signed, JL.
I think that I shall never see a sight so curious as BP. This place, called up at war's behest, and peopled with the queerly dressed. Yet what they did, they could not say, nor ever shall till Judgment Day. For 6 long years we have been there, subject to local scorn and stare. We come by transport and by train, the dull, the brilliantly insane. What were we for? Where shall we be when God at last reduns BP? The Air Force types that never fly, soldiers who neither do nor die, landlubber sailors, beards complete, long-haired civilians, slim, effete. Why they were there, they never knew. And when they told, it wasn't true. If I should die, think this of me. I served my country at BP. And should my son ask, what did you in the atomic World War II? God only knows. And he won't tell. For after all, BP is hell.
Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me. Anyone else but me. Anyone else but me. No, no, no. Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me. Till I come marching home.
They were an extraordinary crowd. I mean, they were so wonderful, the code breakers. Nearly every new code they were trying to break was just so agonising, because every minute meant thousands of people's lives were at risk. I had to get out of the Official Secrets Act in order to give a lecture about what I was doing at Bletchley. I rang up some old boffin and said, I have signed the Official Secrets Act. I have been asked to give a lecture to the SAS about my time at Bletchley. And I thought, well, I must just tell somebody I'm going to do it, because I haven't spoken about it for about 30 years. And so I rang up the boffin and said, that's perfectly all right. You're not likely to say anything that will be of any interest. So I thought, well, that's bloody rude. So I said, well, I would need that in writing.
Absolutely.
So I got a letter.
And how many years were you here for?
5 years. Anybody else would have done it if they happened to find themselves in that position.
So when you left at the end, was that pretty much the end of activity in Bletchley at the time?
Well, yes, I suppose it probably was, but I was asked to go and learn Japanese and do the Japanese war, so I went up to London at that point and did learn Japanese and did translate Japanese. Well, it seems extraordinary when you look at these funny old things, which is us, that we actually did it, doesn't it? And they were all working incredibly hard. I mean, we regularly worked 12-hour shifts. But I worked 24-hour shift over the Bismarck thing because I just happened to get it. By today's standards, I would say we were workaholics. We were lucky enough to be here at the right time, in the right place. We were able to do what we did because of that. And it may be the most important thing that any of us ever done in our lives. We didn't realise it at the time, but we do now.
8th of May 1945. Message from the Director General. On this ever memorable day, I desire that all who are doing duty in this organisation should be made aware of my unbound admiration at the way in which they have carried out their allotted tasks. Such have been the difficulties, such has been the endeavour, and such have been the constant triumphs, that one senses that words of gratitude from one individual are perhaps out of place. The personal knowledge of the contribution made towards winning the war is surely the real measure of the thanks which so rightly belong to one and all in a great and inspired organisation which I have the privilege to direct. This is your finest hour. Signed, S.G. Mingus.
My parents, who died in 1970 and 71, never knew what I did here. Everybody knew about Bletchley Park. Oh, it's some Foreign Office place. Hush, hush. You were allowed to tell your parents that because, I mean, you know, it was a common name that people knew about. Oh, she's at Bletchley Park. Yes. Oh, hush, hush, hush. Yes, I understand, sort of thing. I think they and I accepted that that was what had been laid down and they didn't ask. I suppose, yes, possibly, I was sorry that they'd both died before I could tell them. When, after they'd died, of course, everything came out. Remember my friend saying the same. Both her parents died before they knew what their daughter had done in the war.
But never the slightest temptation, by the sounds of it, on your part to tell them.
Oh, no.
Because it was absolutely...
Mind you, possibly thinking back, we joined the Navy, we joined the Wrens, and we were under service discipline. And it would never occur to us to flout that.
How did you feel about later on, when it all started to come out? I mean, it wasn't very long after your parents...
I was horrified.
Oh, really?
Absolutely horrified, I don't mind telling you. My great friend rang me up and said, have you heard? They're talking all about Bletchley. It's all over the papers. I said, what? We were told never to talk about it. I still find it extremely hard to take in that everything that was locked in my head for so long is now common knowledge. It never occurred to us that anything would be released later on. I had the time of my life here. I enjoyed myself very, very much. Bletchley was like its own town. There was an incredible amount of social life going on here. There was a thriving theatre whose director was a captain in the army called Captain Malcolm Howgate, and he was always known as Milky. Cowan Gate. At any rate, one of my great friends was lucky enough to be accepted at an audition for a play they did there called Yes, My Darling Daughter. And the leading lady in that was a Belgian ATS sergeant called Jeanne Kamerz, whose father, subsequently after the war, I discovered, was quite a famous film producer. There were all sorts of weird people here, you know. Interesting weird people, too. The novelist Agnes Wilson, he was here with his partner, Bentley Bridgewater, and they were the nuts. But no, it was great fun. It really was. I made a lot of good friends here.
I was put on what we call SLU forward position, and I was sent to Reims, where the peace was signed. And whilst the peace was being signed, I was passing information back to London so that it could be ratified by people in London. And so I can really say I was part of the peace signing system.
Yeah.
From Reims, I went to Frankfurt. I think from there is rather a human story or a humane story, whichever. The war had only been over about 3 days. And I looked round Frankfurt, and as far as I could see, it was all knocked down. And I was picked up, went to an ex-German barracks, which were much better than our barracks, and we were told not to go out. We did our three-shift system, and when we came back to our billets in the barracks, all we could do was lie on our beds. Till after about 2 or 3 weeks, one of my colleagues said, "I'm sick of this." He said, "I'm going to get a wagon and go somewhere." So about 6 of us piled into a wagon, and we went through the camp gates, and we went about 7 or 8 miles out of Frankfurt, and we came to a small hamlet. I think it was called Karlbach. And when we got there, and being with the American army, we never got short of cigarettes, although I've never smoked, or chocolate, or toffees. And so we'd previously put some cigarettes and toffees in our pockets. And within 10 minutes of us coming to this little hamlet, we were surrounded by children. So we emptied our pockets of toffees, and then the wife started coming out. And then about 5 or 6 men came out, and we handed them cigarette and tobacco, which in those days in Germany was used as currency. There was just one bar, and it was open, and it only sold cider, or as the Germans call it, Apfelwein. And so the following Saturday night, we decided we'd break camp again, which we did, and we went back to this village, and I remember us sitting in this single bar with the men and the women, and 2 or 3 weeks before we'd been killing them. And we were all holding hands and singing songs and having a good time on the Apfelwein. And I've often thought, when we start talking about wars, why the hell don't we all sit down together and have a glass of cider?
We were in the Newmanry, as it was called. We were treated with not familiarity, but great respect, and that made it all very much easier. And, of course, girls are gregarious by nature, and we're all great friends. Yeah. It was like a family, and it was a crucial moment. Many girls came straight from school. As I said, I'd been to university, so I was that much older. But getting away from Mum and fetching the fish on Tuesday and all the stuff you do at home, you know. And there were some who were more innocent than you'd believe possible. one little 17-year-old really didn't know what men were for, she said.
And did you ever sneak out and get down to London or things like that?
All the time, yes. Did you? Yes. The dodge was to find a stopping train, and one that was followed fairly quickly by another, so you could stop at one of the little stations on the way to London, I forget what they were called, or on the way to Oxford, and you had to make sure there was another train coming along behind. You got out, you changed out of your uniform, you stuffed it in the manger, put on your glad rags, which you brought in a plastic, or the equivalent of a plastic bag, and went up to London all glamorous for your evening out. But of course it depended on being certain that on the way back the same operation, yes, could be repeated. Luckily, a lot of the officers had no idea what we got up to. And it was part of the fun, really.
And do you look back, in general, that it was fun?
I look back that it was fun, and I look back at the fact that whatever other nonsense, even if I'd been a hopeless wife and a lousy mother, there was one moment when I did something which was really useful. I did once do something valuable for my country.
Your service was invaluable, and yes, thank you so much for your service.
Well, you know, it was lucky that we came to such an unusual and really rather sparkly place, even though we weren't allowed to see much of it. It was fun being here. The vibes were very good.
Nothing is left for me to say except good luck and goodbye. And this. The Official Secrets Act will be rigidly enforced as long as there is any possibility of another war. But some of you, who live to be very old, may read one day what the work in BP as a whole, of which yours was a vital part, really meant. Not only to your own country, but to the world. And then you can be proud, and tell your grandchildren the story of the tapes that spun on silver wheels, and how the skill and determination of free men and women, guided by the light of reason freely used, helped to turn the evil tide of fascist irrationalism and slavery in Europe. J.W.J. Herivelt.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.